Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now.
Talk Production, a black-owned radio network that discusses solutions to the issue concerning the black community, presents Black Urban America. All you guys that are listening by laptop, if you have a comment or a question for our guest this evening, the call-in number is 516-531-9540. That's 516-531-9540, and press 1. The lineup for our week, Tuesday, this evening, we have Black Urban America, I'm your host, Kenny Jones. On the on Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Michonne. Name is Michonne Williams. On Thursday, we had Ports of Harlem by Wayne A. Young. And on Saturday, we had Provocative Thought with Carlton Steve. Tonight we have an interesting topic to discuss, and they say this theory, Black Liberation Theology, go way back to Malcolm and Martin. And the guest tonight we have from the Aya Educational Institute and the Interdenominational Theological Center will discuss Black Liberation Theology, and her name is Miss Ayanna Michelle. Are you there, Miss Michelle?
I'm with you. How are you, brother?
Okay. Welcome to Black Urban America, and I want you to meet my co-host, Michonne Williams. Michonne Williams, this is Miss Michelle.
Hello. How are you?
Hello. I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. It's nice meeting you.
Good,
yes, sir.
Good.
Likewise.
Tell us, what is Black Liberation Theology?
In a nutshell, because it's a perspective that has deep roots and new vines. In a nutshell, Black Liberation Theology focuses on the injustices committed against African Americans and African-descended people It focuses on Christianity, but also its roots are in civil rights, the Black Power movement, Black consciousness, and most importantly, liberation from the evils of empire and many of the powers that be that suppress true freedom and expression within the Black community, specifically the Black spiritual community.
What are some of the struggles that people that follow the Black liberation theology perspective, what are some of those struggles that face for Black Americans today?
I think the father of Black liberation theology, the Dr. James Cone, really formulated this thought and this perspective from issues, these multiple forms of political, social, economic, religious subjugation, gender suppression, and these kinds of oppressions and oppressive tactics and mechanisms that would keep people of color from truly acknowledging, feeling, and experiencing the greatness that is within them, that is inherent, that is inborn, that is embedded within the fibers of our beings. And so Black liberation theology challenges and it really agitates and it serves to agitate the religious community in particular in ways that are probably uncomfortable or more than likely uncomfortable for Western society and Western where Christianity and spirituality are concerned. But once we rustle up that rock and the gravel and we begin to sift through it, then we're able to truly acknowledge the powers that work to keep us from truly being liberated.
I'm going to ask a couple of historical questions. Did Malcolm force the Black Christian Church to look at themselves?
I think when we look at our leaders in our society, specifically our religious and cultural society, let me say it like this, the warrior is not embraced until the enemy's at the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say that to shine some light on the idea that anytime you are agitating and aggravating the status quo, there's going to be pushback because it's a mobilization which creates movement. And so Malcolm and Martin, although they had different means by which coming to the end, I believe the heart, the spirit, the soul was really fighting for the same justice.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's not so much about the battle as it is about the passion that stirs it, that moves it, that mobilizes it, and that makes people want to rock the boat, so to speak. Because liberation calls you to do that quite naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's something that's within us, that drive and desire to seek justice, fairness, equity. I think that is, we see that throughout the circle of life.
How do a person or how do a cause or a religious sect use religion for empowerment?
Let me say this. Black liberation theology does have its roots in the religious sector. However, it also pushes forward this idea of religious freedom and freedom to acknowledge spirit however one may do so. I think that we acknowledge as people of color that there certainly have been conflicts within the Christian structure, within the biblical text, within the way in which religion has been appropriated in our community. I think we have to first acknowledge that there are some flaws, that the biblical text, although it is our book of law and order in this particular country, we also acknowledge all of the other text that makes the African roots of the Bible what they are. When we look at the Apocrypha, when we look at the Kabbalah, when we look at the Quran, when we look at the books that have been removed from the current text we acknowledge as the biblical truth, when we embrace our ecological connection to Mother Earth, to African spiritualities like Ifa and Yoruba, and these various cultures, when we as people of color embrace all of who we are, then I think we have a better perspective in understanding that it's not so much about the sect as it is about acknowledging the intention and the need for us to continue to fight this battle so that our people will indeed have equity and freedom to believe the stories that are told in our own communities.
Mm. It's a battle.
Absolutely. But it also is about us embracing us and embracing our earliest teachers. And so you mentioned my affiliation with Aya Educational Institute, and they are an African-centered education, and it is developed and run, created by Baba Wakessa and his wife, Afia Mazimoyo. And what we understand is that our earliest teachers don't necessarily have degrees and, you know, high accolades. They're the Sunday school teachers. They're our grandparents. They are the elders in our community. And so we embrace all of that under the guise of African education, but also Black liberation, spiritually and educationally, so that we begin to know who we are and tell our stories so that they bring light to the excellence that is within us inherently.
I'll go ask one more question before I turn over to Michonne. The question I really want to ask right now, I'm not going to ask until later. How do you integrate faith and Black identity?
That's a good question. Faith and Black identity, I believe, go hand in hand. There's not one without the other. And I think first, in our faith communities, we are, I think, embracing now more than ever, because there has been a resurrection of us, of who we are, and this movement of awakening that we see and feel in the Black community. But Black identity, in order to be Black in this America, in this society, I don't think one can exist without a system of belief, without a belief that things will get better and are gradually getting better. So I think they work together, but I think it's important that within our Black spiritual communities, we erect images that look true to who our ancestors and biblical ancestors were. And so when we begin to erect images of the dark-skinned Black comedic Jesus, Yeshua images, with the more ethnic features And I'm not talking about a kind of sliding by halfway looking like a black Jesus. I'm talking about black Jesus with the locks and the wool and the dark skin. I think when our children can identify in their earliest formative foundational years in faith, I think it's certainly a conflict psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually to look up and see the image of a white Jesus, of a white Savior in general. I think that creates great psychological conflict for us as we seek to be liberated, but we're looking at the image of a figure that looks much that is the image of our oppressor. And so I think we're challenged in that way to, and I think even as simple as giving our children, presenting them with images in the home that look like them. So when we purchase dolls for our daughters and images of superheroes for our sons, who do they look like? And so if the Savior itself is illustrated to look like the oppressor, then what does that say about the power within us, the power we're drawing from this Savior story? The story of a liberator who very much looks and is us, you know.
Yes.
So it's a lot to unpack, but I think our community is ready for this resurgence of awareness.
Go ahead, Michonne.
Okay, I have several questions. My first one is, do you elevate culture over scripture?
Do I elevate culture over scripture? Let me say this. I am, I have a background educationally in psychology and counseling and the rehabilitation field, clinical work. But spiritually, I was reared in a home with a mother who was Pentecostal, holiness, apostolic background from the South in Miami. And my father, who was reared in the Black United Methodist Church in the North in Maryland. And so I grew up in the United Methodist Church, particularly often visiting the Holiness Church and still definitely having a space there because my grandmother is a Pentecostal preacher. And so I very much had the balance and the luxury of that duality. But I was appointed associate pastor in the United Methodist Church and have been preaching and teaching in the United Methodist Church since I was about 13 years old. And so as I journeyed through the spiritual community, the religious community, particularly the Black religious community, there were many spiritual conflicts, questions, challenges, curiosities I had. And would often challenge the authority, the Sunday school teachers, to ask the questions where things didn't make sense. For instance, an eye for an eye, but turn the other cheek. You know, these kinds of dualities in the biblical text. And so as I matured, not only professionally and educationally, but also spiritually, I needed these questions answered. I needed to be able to interrogate and wrestle within myself, but also within the text in a way that was scholarship, because that's important to me. Also in the family I've been reared in, education is important, and intellect is important. Not so much about the degrees, but the knowing, the thirst for knowledge and more. And so after my master's degree at the University of Maryland, Eastern Shore Historically Black Institution, I was working in the church as an associate pastor, also working at the university as a residential counselor and a housing director. So I was living with students who had all kinds of challenges they were coming through and to in their lives as college students. And so a lot of the questions and conflicts, as I spoke with students and I did my work in the church, I realized people didn't have as much of a grasp on the why, as you would think we would as religious people in the Black community. A lot of times I would ask pastors and leaders in the church questions, and there would be an answer, but it didn't seem to satisfy my longing for the more. And so I decided to come to seminary from Maryland, where I grew up and attended institution, and I came to Atlanta, Georgia, to the Interdenominational Theological Center. And it is there that I have had the opportunity to interrogate the text in a way that is honest, but also that honors the reality that oppression and liberation are always in conflict in this society. And so I began to see teachers and leaders and professors who were preachers and teachers, but also who brought about the reality of what the text is and its historical lens as well as its literary lens. So to answer your question in a long way, I believe that Spirit speaks to each of us through our experiences and brings us to the answers and to the teachers. There's a quote that says, when the pupil is ready, the master appears. And so when we seek for ourselves the truth, and the truth, I believe, may be different for each of us, but when we seek it, Spirit sends the answer for us. And for me, at the ITC, the Interdenominational Theological Center, it was there that I saw and that I see, because I'm currently a student, finishing up this year, but it's here that I see Black liberation meet spirituality. And that takes on various forms, from ritual and rites of passage to Yoruba Ifa languages, the indigenous spiritualities of African people. It also embraces all of the ecumenical faith traditions, from the Methodists to the Baptists, the Pentecostals, you know, the Lutherans. So you have a body that is interfaith. And so it allows us to embrace all of that and challenge it at the same time, because we have a right to do so. And liberation allows us the freedom to challenge a text that has been written by human beings, maybe
Sister
inspired
Michelle,
by God.
Michelle.
Yes.
Sister
yes.
Michelle. I had scholars on the show. I had politicians on the show. I have educators on the show, business. So you got me taking notes, Sister Michelle T.
Let's go, brother. Let's go, sis, because you're asking the questions, I think. That,
no, I'm just giving you accolades. Go ahead,
I appreciate that. I appreciate it. But
you got
me all of
notes, man, like I'm in class.
Hey, you
is
know.
Black liberation theology heresy?
Is it heresy? Explain yes. that for me. Give me a little bit of background on the, your
heresy.
Yes.
Okay. Heresy is a belief or opinion contrary to the orthodox religion or doctrine.
Is it contrary?
So,
I think Black liberation. I would not say it's heresy. No. I think when we understand that the biblical text is an African text. So it's an African text that has been translated over thousands of years, many, many, many versions and translations of the text we read as biblical truth. And so if the question is it heresy, then I would ask,
okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to, have you ever heard of the laws of Maat?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, do you believe that some of the laws and statutes from the Bible, like the Ten Commandments, which the laws of Maya were way older than the Bible, were stolen.
Oh,
the laws of Maya.
There are many, many, I think, aspects of the text that have been reframed, rewritten, especially when you consider languages. And you consider the first languages, if you look at the Coptic texts, and then you begin to look at Greek, Hebrew, Latin, you know, and all the many variations of those. English is, you know, a very young language and culture. And so you must consider what came before that. And I would challenge those who are inquiring to consider if the biblical text was presented to us, then what was before it, before it was written, before the Nicene Conference and these conferences where the biblical text was orchestrated, it was decided what was going to be kept, what was going to be discarded, what was intentionally kept from us, and then also understanding that only the intelligentsia were able to read. And so the illiteracy and understanding that there are there were status of people, caste and class systems that were allowed to read and to be educated. So who was the text truly for? Who understood it? Who narrated it? Who taught it? If the people who it was being taught to were not literate of that text and language. And then how has it changed? Each time there's a translation in language, a translation in version. We've got the King James, we've got the NIV, we've got, you know, all of these versions. And so when we acknowledge it as literary text and not necessarily an infallible text, because if humanity's flawed and humanity wrote the text inspired by, said to be inspired by our biblical ancestors, then is it heresy?
I have to ask you something else. Since you mentioned about the Bible with the different versions and texts, and since it was translated by all these different people who were not for us, that were against us, do you believe, because I personally believe, that our ancestors left us all this information in stone, this proof, which they did. Now, since the Bible was used against us to oppress us, it was also used by our enemies to enslave us, why would a black person even consider going with Christianity or believing anything in the Bible? Because of the foundational roots from when we got to America and before. For what it was used,
well, you say,
to oppress
you
us,
say it's
everything. Slavery, it was used to justify it.
Absolutely.
They used it. I mean, so why would, because a lot of black people I know are turning away from it. They consider it woke, being woke. So what is the difference between black liberation theology and a woke Christian, which I don't believe in a woke Christian because I don't believe you can be woke and a Christian. But can you explain?
I can try, and I'm not the expert on any of this. This is my my conviction. This is my belief.
Okay.
You said something important, and I want to address it from several angles because it brings up some strong points. And you talked about the stone and this information being written and being there on the stone. Certainly, if we look just in terms of history, the pyramids, the hieroglyphs, the catacombs all tell the stories of the spiritual encounters, the many, many, many vast spiritual encounters that the first people and the first people had with spirit. In terms of the stone, there, if we remember in the biblical text, Jesus, the Yeshua, left no written documentation. There was an account of a writing in the sand, but certainly sand is not going to, you know, hold a script. But the stone is likened in African spirituality to the bone. And when we talk about the bones of our ancestors and the bones that our bodies are endowed with, it is there that the memory is written. It is in those places that our deepest spiritualities are written. The DNA, and this is why family lineage, this is why generational lineage is so important to Black liberation theology, because our stories, and I said all of that about the biblical text, not to defile it, because it is my foundation. I'm still a preacher, and I still am convicted by the foundation that was laid by my ancestors, my community. This is my first encounter with spirit. It was in the Black church, and it still is. It has its very energy there. But our narratives, which are also the biblical narratives, are as important. My life story is scripture. It is as valuable as the text in what we call the Bible. If you were to write your story, the experience you have with spirit, the experience you have with humanity, with the ecological system, with the earth, with the elements of the earth, all of that, the narrative of spirit. When we leave here, before we came here, none came with a Bible or a text or any particular written manual for how life should be lived. But in Black liberation and African spirituality, we rely on us. We rely on the community. We rely on the earth to engage and to teach us what this life is about. And as we all move through it, whatever the challenges are to overcome in your life, whatever your tailor-made challenges are, whatever the pathway is for you, is your closest encounter with theology. It is a system of beliefs. It is a perspective. And so I believe in the biblical foundation, because it has its root in the African context and reality. And so it is me. It is you. And I don't think that they should necessarily be delineated. I think we should embrace them all. Whatever calls to you in terms of what speaks to your spirit. For some, it's hip-hop and theology. I'm an age baby.
It's been said that.
Yeah. You know, I'm an age baby.
Let me ask you this, sure. Sister Michelle. You said before that the African text is through the Bible. How about the Black Power movement? Is the Black Power movement in the Bible? In that text?
We live it. Absolutely. It's all there and it's all here. And it, because out of the nothing comes the everything. And when you have a reason to fight, to move forward, to push a generation forward, then it's valid. Then it is so. Because we make it so. And so this term, Ashe, you know, we say that a lot. We hear that a lot in the African community. It is the energy that makes it so. That even if it ain't so, I believe it to be so. And I'm going to make it so because I have within me the magic, the energy, the force to make it so. And all of my ancestors. So we started out talking about Martin and Malcolm and what they believe. This is who we are. It's all of that. It is all of that. It is all of us. And I'll tell you, in African spirituality and Black liberation theology, there are rites of passage. And we experience them every day. We just don't necessarily call them that. But one of them that I love the most is when the young men are about to move over into from adolescence into manhood, one of the rites of passage is that they must stand before the elders, and they must be able to tell who their family, their generation, who their lineage was made up of seven generations.
People can't do that today. People can't do
that today. And we should do that today, because when we do that, we identify what gifts move through the lineage, through the family line, through our hands, through our bodies. When you hear people say, oh, my grandmother, my aunties, they were all business owners. They were all chefs. They were all preachers and teachers on my mama's side, on my daddy's. We hear that. Important to acknowledge and embrace and do the work that our souls must have, in order for us to identify that, draw from it, and be able to activate it to make justice appear as it should for us. And so,
well,
why do white
Christians feel that black liberation theology cites anger?
It threatens empire. It threatens the status quo. It threatens what keeps a people flowing at the ebb with which empire desires the tide to flow. And I think when we look back, even in the days of the plantation time, for black people to gather was not legal. Literally, you could be killed for being in a gathering on the plantation with more than three people. Why do you think that is? You know, and so when you look at why the preachers and the worshipers had to steal away into the brush harbors at night and sing into the bucket, because what happens when our people come together is there is an activation. There is a conjuring of energy, of movement, of kinetic force that changes and shifts the very atmospheric energy. This is why whenever you put black folk in any genre, and they like to say that we are only good at sports, but you put us in medicine, in the arts, in the fine arts, put us in any genre, music. Look at James Brown. That man was ticking at levels that the average white man couldn't even dream of moving his feet, let alone keeping the tempo and the beat. That's who we are. We are connected to the very universe and atmospheric energy and power. And so when you put us together, things are going to happen. When you take a Stacey Abrams and a Kamala Harris, vice president, when you put these energies together, things happen and folk get angry because change is uncomfortable. And it shifts the power structure, the economic power in this country. When you change the structure of what was designed to be. So when the Constitution was written, me nor you were considered a whole individual. So if we are continuing to live the laws of the land of the Constitution that did not consider us, then where do we exist in this reality?
Speaking of uncomfortability, I'm gonna ask a couple of uncomfortable questions. All right, and you speak of the Bible being the African text or what have you. Is there racism in the Bible?
Absolutely. Okay. I think any issue that this life could present to us, we can find it in that text, because it's life, it's allegory, it is the reflection of the condition of humanity and spirit and how they interact. It is no different than if we were to write our story today and how spirit interacts with us and how our society looks. You know, we have to consider it in the context that it was written, consider who wrote it, what year it was written, what was going on in place and space and time, and who it was written for. And so, and then how it, if we believe that there have been manipulations, which absolutely you can't have a version of anything without it being manipulated. It's not an original, it's a version. So any version of the Bible we're reading has been reinterpreted. And in many instances, there are not words adequate enough to reinterpret from one language to the other. So you're going to lose some meaning. You're going to lose some context. But it's how we read into that narrative that puts us there or not. And when we look at Exodus, these were a people yearning to be free. These
like
are people who were in captivity, absolutely. So no matter where we find ourselves in the generational line, the human condition is going to present us with the challenges that we must warrior up, be healers and builders in our communities so that we can move our generations forward. And
well,
all of that.
But how can you do that? Now, you see the current generation today, okay? You know, a lot of our families have a lot of pain.
Oh, yeah.
How can you heal that pain?
That's
and
a good
also,
question.
Not only our families, a lot of our communities around this country have a lot of pain. So, how can we go through the healing process?
Wow,
because,
you just said it.
You know, right now, I'm reading the book Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, which is a powerful book.
Dr. DeGruy, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a segment in there to talk about healing. Everybody healing. Okay, what's the healing process? Tell me, how can the black man of America today go through this healing process after, you know, with this new Jim Crow laws? Identified by Michelle Alexander, same name, Michelle Alexander, you know, with this new Jim Crow laws. So how do we go through this healing process with police brutality, do black liberation theology address police brutality, the homelessness, being lost for words, being incarcerated, the racism, then you talk about oppression, now the healing after all this is going on. Oh, the wealth gap. Let's not bring up the wealth gap. A lot of, a lot of the black business owners that come on here talk about the wealth gap. Okay, how do we go through this process? If that's a part of the struggles, how do we go through the process of healing, utilizing this philosophy? What is the healing process?
I felt that. I felt that question. I felt it.
I talk about black men. Well, I talk about black men. I get a little compassion because I'm a black man.
Absolutely. You said it. The key word is community. Healing for... Let me back up a little bit because I mentioned my background as a student studying psychology and counseling in the Western perspective. Prior to coming to seminary of all black ecumenical seminary, the only all black ecumenical seminary, and studying psychology and counseling under black psychologists. And I will tell you, in the Western frame of therapy, counsel, they move with a survival of the fittest energy, a lean that is survival of the fittest. I go into the therapist's office, we're one-on-one, I give them my issues, my concerns, they help me to work through them, XYZ. In African community, in tribal community, it is survival of the tribe. And so when there is an issue in the African tribal community, that person comes into community, into the circle that surrounds that individual. And everyone from the village, everyone from the township, everyone from the community comes and gathers around that individual and pours into them from the time that child was born. There's an elder there to remind them of their earliest feats, what they did as little children, what energy and spirit that child had. And then you have people who go around in that communal way and lift that spirit, that soul up. And so I think in the Western way, we are taught to go into the closet, close the door, deal with our issues on our own. Don't talk about what happened in this house. What happened in this house, stay in this house. Right? We're taught that.
Don't hang your dirty laundry on the line.
That's it. You got it. And so when we look at shifting, and this is why the narrative is so important, to come back to what has been for us. Segregated schools were a wonderful thing if we look at them in the context that we see education now, if we were to compare. Because in the segregated school system, you had black teachers.
I was going to ask something like that later on, but I'm still going to ask that question.
We're all flowing. Absolutely. You had prayer. You had a time of centering the self. You had a time of coming together and reflecting on gratitude and honor and appreciation and value for what we had. There was an interest. When black children were chosen to be in the school play, guess what? Little black girl can be the Cinderella in the play. She's not having to compete with the racism that we experience many times as we're growing up in the public school system, integrated system, where our children are overlooked or our black children are being medicated, tranquilized, like animals. The segregation was taught to us as a, you know, yes, we need to integrate, and there were wonderful positives to that. But at the same time, we are, as African-centered education educators, we are embracing that construct. Homeschool came from the African way. Montessori and these kind of free-flowing, free-thinking. And so to get back to your question, the way we heal this pain, I believe, as a person with a background in healing, mind, body, and spirit, is to come together, to trust in us. There is no right way because there are infinite ways within the magic of who we are. And so there's a concept in African thought called Sankofa. And Sankofa is represented. Yeah, if you see the image, it's represented with a beautiful, graceful bird with its head looking turned back and an egg in its mouth. And that concept and image tells us to go back as a community, as a people, as a body, as a oneness, to go back and get what was taught to us, our ways of being, our folk ways, our mores, what has gotten us over. Get that. Fetch it, because it's the only way you're going to have what you need to move forward. And plant that egg, plant that seed, birth that generation to be able to know where they came from and where they're going and what's in them. Because as you said, there are warriors within us. We hear the stories of being overpowered on the plantation, but there are thousands of stories of insurrection, the Denmark Vesies, and these people who rose up, took over, slayed the oppression, left them completely slayed, and went on to liberate more people. These are the Harriet Tubmans of that time. And not enough of those narratives are told. So the beginning of our healing is community. It's going back, listening to the stories of the elders, but also the elders embracing the ingenuity and the genius of our children. Because we've heard, many of us have heard the saying, oh, that baby done been here before. This ain't her first day.
Or she's an old soul. Or that baby's old soul.
You got it. That's right. And all of that is because what is written on our bones, sister. And I'm glad she talked about that, those tablets and that writing, because the magic of us, the genius of us, the excellence of us, the yearning to be free of us is written on our bones. And every generation has that imprinted. You talked about the post-traumatic slave syndrome. Yes, but in that voyage, in that middle passage, the millions, thousands of trips of human cargo that were taken back and forth, there was an imprinting being done of survival, of regeneration. I have a great teacher, Dr. Will Coleman. He is a brilliant ascended master and teacher here at the ITC. He talks about the imprinting on the bone as our people laid on that middle passage for all of those months and months and months. And the ones who made it, by the time they got to where they were being taken, they had imagined a new way. They had already morphed into a new being that was required to survive whatever conditions, whether they were in the islands or in the North Americas, wherever they were taken to. By the time they got there, already in their bones, shifted and morphed and recreated and reimagined and remanifested who they needed to be. And I will say this, there was no civilization before our people civilized it in these Americas. So when you think about a people who were lined up on a middle passage,
there was no civilization of white folks until they ran into us. We civilized the world.
Absolutely. Period. You know, the black Moors taught the white women how to bathe. They, mm-hmm. Imagine that atrocity, right? And so when we look at the brilliance of a people snatched from their land, brought to a foreign place, where they didn't know the culture, the climate, or anything, beaten into a submission, yet, these people who spoke different languages from different tribes all over the continent figured out how to communicate with each other. Why? Because we are creators of language. Why? Because we were brilliant when we were removed from our soil. We were not slaves brought here. You brought architects. And medicine men and women. You brought teachers and spiritualists. You brought agriculturalists. Think about a land that was not civilized and your people civilizing it. It's when we are reminded and when we remember all of the dismembered parts that have been intentionally dismembered, then we can begin to understand the value, the genius, the superiority of us.
Well, how
there's
come?
Nothing, there's nothing more powerful.
Well, let me ask you this. How come? I might be getting a little personal here, but how come black preachers and ministers are not teaching that cultural African-centered identity in their church? You still got some churches today that got the white Jesus up there. So how come they have not adopted this framework? Because, you know, to go back to what Marcus Garvey said, you know, you should believe in the black God. You know, the God is the image of you. How come these preachers today are not adopting this philosophy?
I can't speak for all preachers. I can speak for a perspective that I think, just based on my experiences in the black church and my continued experience in the black church. I think we're seeing more millennials in particular challenge the construct of structure in general, whether it's the economic powers, the political powers. I mean, we've seen more political participation from the black community that we've ever seen. And so I think each generation has a mission to be the rebel for their time, for their generation. I think more people, more churches are embracing, especially when you look at your African churches, African Methodist churches, various churches that have the deeper roots in liberation theology. However, it is the same challenge as going into the toy store and buying white dolls for our children. It's the same challenge as choosing to go to a big box superstore as opposed to the black produce stand, the black market in our community. It is the same challenge because you're not going to always have a fair economic shot. For instance, when we look at charter schools, you know, I personally would love to see all of our children be in African-centered education. However,
I need to ask your questions. We're running out of time.
I got you. We can resume. I just want to ask one more question.
And then we have to go.
Sure.
How do you feel now, aside from everything else, you know, I believe that I'm talking about a brother from your neck of the woods, Mishawn, Chicago. I feel that Reverend Jeremiah Wright was a black liberation theologist. How do you feel he was treated by President Obama?
I think given President Obama's position, I think within the black community we have an understanding. And I believe there was an understanding there that we may not, as the general public, have been able to see. I think Reverend Wright, who I have great respect for, understood President Obama's position. And I think President Obama always will honor and reverence the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. However, a lot of times the political playing field is played in such a way that sometimes we have to nod and dab each other visually, because we know that the work that's being done, the work that we are doing together in a room, can't always be a high five, but we have to coexist in spaces where we understand each other but may move in different ways. And I think that's what we saw when we saw that. But I think there is always a respect there. I think that I don't think anything changed. I just think the position that President Obama was in, he had to play the game, if I can say that. quite honestly, he had to play the game, you know, and so you know. But that's a whole other conversation.
Thank you. I thank you, Sister Michelle, for coming on the show.
Thank you both.
You had
invited me. Having me.
I know our listeners and downloaders are really going to be listening to this show. I thank you, and I honor you. Okay.
All right, folks. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's another week. And powerful thought process. Very powerful. And we have to start thinking along those lines. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. And listen to The Cutting Edge tomorrow night. Good night.
Hold it now.